saying enough, and you know they cannot and will not tolerate any more oppressions. You mentioned earlier about the settlers. We all seen the practices of those settlers against right. the women, children, the elderly. Now, you mentioned about maybe another front. Well, you know, Sayyid Nasrallah a couple okay. of times, you know, said we're ready when we are asked. But hope, you know, the Palestinian will remain steadfast in the resistance. And, you know,
sure.
maybe some pressure from inside Israel, you know, on this war-crazy government.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're fresh out of time. Ali Malavar, founder of Al-Quds Day in Toronto. Thank you so much. Chris Williamson, thank you. Host of Press TV's Palestine Declassified from Derby, UK. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with Ayah 35 to 37 of Surah Ali Imran, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dhurriyatan ba'dhuha min ba'dhin wallahu samiyun alim. إذ قالت امرأة عمران رب إني نذرت لك ما في بطني محررا فتقبل مني إنك أنت السميع العليم فلما وضعتها قالت رب إني وضعتها أنثى والله أعلم بما وضعت والله أعلم بما وضعت وليس الذكر كالأنثى وإني سميتها مريم وإني أعيذها بك وذريتها من الشيطان الرجيم فتقبلها ربها بقبول حسن وأنبتها نباتا حسنا وكفلها زكريا كلما دخل عليها زكريا المحراب وجد عندها رزقا قال يا مريم أنى لك هذا قالت هو من عند الله إن الله يرزق من يشاء بغير حساب.
In the name of Allah, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. When the wife of Imran said, My Lord, dedicate to you what is in my belly in consecration, accept it from me. Indeed, you are the All-Hearing, the All-Knowing. And when she bore her, she said, My Lord, I have borne a female child, and Allah knew better what she had borne. And the female is not like the male. I've named it Mary, and I commend her and her offspring to your care against evil of the outcast Satan. Thereupon her Lord accepted her with a gracious acceptance and made her grow up in a worthy fashion, and he charged Zechariah with her care. Whenever Zechariah visited her in the sanctuary, he would find provision with her. He said, O Mary, from where does this come for you? She said, It comes from Allah. Allah provides whomever He wishes without any reckoning.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
First, TV headlines. Israel has killed more than 700 children in its ongoing onslaught on the besieged Gaza Strip amid silence of its Western allies. Hamas political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh says that Israel's plot to evacuate people of Gaza is doomed to fail, as Palestinians will not leave their homeland. And Iran has warned that the continuation of Israeli crimes against Palestinians will change the situation in the entire region. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Israeli regime keeps pounding the densely populated Gaza Strip relentlessly for the eighth day in a row, killing civilians and reducing buildings in the besieged Palestinian territory to rubble. In one of the latest strikes, the regime killed 27 Palestinians in Jabalia, north of the Gaza Strip. Around 2,300 Palestinians have been killed and nearly 10,000 wounded. Over 700 children are among the dead. At least 15 hospitals have been damaged by Israeli shelling and air raids. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says at least 21 Israelis and foreigners held by the group were also killed in the airstrikes. Attacks began last Saturday. More than 420,000 Gazans have been displaced since then. Now more than 1 million Palestinians in northern Gaza face an Israeli deadline on Saturday to flee the south. The territory remains under Israel's complete siege with no access to electricity, water, food, and medicines. Hamas chief Ismail Haniyeh has accused Israel of committing war crimes and preventing humanitarian aid from entering Gaza. As part of its Operation Al-Aqsa flood against Israel, Hamas has been firing thousands of missiles into the occupied territories. The Palestinian resistance movement has now carried out the farthest launch since its military campaign began on Saturday. Palestinians say the Ayash 250 was fired at Israel's northern command base in the city of Safed. Israel media claimed that it was intercepted by the regime's missile systems. Sirens were sounded all the way from settlements close to the Gaza Strip to cities like Haifa. The missile has a range of 250 kilometers. Hamas had previously stated that it can target anywhere in the Israeli-occupied territories. So far, over 1,500 Israelis have been killed and 3,400 injured in Operation Al-Aqsa Flood by the resistance group. Hamas says it launched a military campaign in response to repeated Israeli desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque and the regime's crimes and aggression throughout the decades. Starat, an Israeli settlement close to the Gaza Strip, has been one of the places where fighters from the resistance movement Hamas
could infiltrate last week during their Al-Aqsa flood operation. Al-Alam Press Corps has toured the settlement following the Hamas lightning operation.
We are here in the Ashdod settlement near the besieged Gaza Strip, which has been subjected to heavy Israeli strikes. Now, of course, many of the settlers have left this area after it was targeted by a barrage of rockets. You can see lots of material damage here, including to cars and buildings, and it happened at a time when there were a lot of settlers here. Ashdod was hit by lots of rockets and missiles, and resistance fighters were present here when they started their Al-Aqsa flood operation. After heavy fighting, the Israeli army took back the control of this area. You see the damage inflicted to houses. A settlement that was once housing many settlers has now turned into a deserted town thanks to the rockets fired by resistance forces. There are now only military forces here. Still, rockets and missiles are being fired toward this area, rockets that are in response to the Israeli regime's crimes against Gaza. This place is located in the so-called Gaza envelope, which has been declared as a closed military zone by the Israeli army. Huge numbers of forces and armored vehicles have been dispatched to this area by the regime, which has called up more than 300,000 of its reservists. The Gaza envelope is still being targeted by rockets and missiles fired by resistance forces. There has also been sporadic fighting in the area, which demonstrates that the regime still does not have full control over all places in the Gaza envelope. The Israeli army is trying to once again bring it back under its full control, while regime intelligence forces have declared it a dangerous zone.
Head of Hamas Political Bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, says Palestinian people will never leave their land, despite the recent Israeli bloodshed in the besieged Gaza Strip. Haniyeh said Palestinians have a country, and their country is Palestine. The Hamas officials said the people of Palestine will not emigrate from their land, despite the Israeli regime's barbaric crimes to eliminate the roots of Palestinian people. Haniyeh said the return of Palestinian people to their ancestral land is close, given the regime's plan, which is assisted by the U.S., is doomed to fail. He praised the military wing of Hamas, the Al-Qassam Brigades, for carrying out the operation against the Israeli regime. Mona Kandil is a correspondent joining us from Akabat, Ramallah, to tell us more about the developments there. Well, Mona, tell us what you got. And one of the things that I'm looking here, is, and I need your confirmation on, is how it seems like the Israeli regime forces have increased the number of people they're arresting. From what I'm reading in one of the sources here, if you can tell us about that also.
Exactly. Almost all the areas across the occupied West Bank arresting up to the moment 55 Palestinians. The majority of those had been detained in Al-Amhari refugee camp. South Ramallah, northern Al-Quds, and the Israeli troops are still there. Clashes had been also reported between Palestinians and Israeli forces near Al-Amhari refugee camp. People were detained in Al-Janazoun refugee camp near Ramallah, in Taqwa, in Beit Lahem, as well as in Ain al-Sultan, in Ariha, in Nablus, in several areas of Nablus, like the village of Tell, as well as the village of Salem. In Al-Khalil, the Israeli forces raided several areas as well, arresting a number of people in Ad-Heshi refugee camp. Reports came from there saying that Israeli forces arrested Palestinians there, as well as in Beit Umar near Al-Khalil, also in Jenin, and in Al-Quds, a number of Palestinians had been detained. So 55 Palestinians had been detained by the Israeli soldiers only in the early hours of Sunday. We have also to mention that Israeli intelligence are trying to reach a number of Palestinians via via making phone calls to them, and say that they have to go to the police stations or the Israeli military bases around the cities just for interrogation. And if they do not come, then the Israelis will raid the area and arrest them. This is exactly what happened to many of the Palestinians, they had to go to the investigation, and immediately when they arrived, they had been detained by the Israeli forces. Why this happens? It happens because at the same time, the people fear that the Israeli forces might raid the areas, might arrest another family members, then they prefer to go to the interrogation, and they had been detained. Only few of Palestinians happened with them this morning. Clashes erupted in several areas across the occupied West Bank, like in Jenin. Palestinians had exchanged fire with the Israeli forces who raided the Jenin, and it's not the first time. Since Saturday, numerous exchange of firing clashes erupted between Israeli forces and the Palestinian fighters there in the Jenin area. Speaking about something else about the development about the Israeli war on the Gaza Strip, we have to say that Netanyahu visited the Israeli kibbutz or Israeli settlement known as Be'eri yesterday, and he comforted the soldiers. And he was, if according, of course, to the analysts, that he was telling them they have to be prepared for the ground operation because the war on the Gaza Strip did not come to an end.
Thank you very much for that. Monica Neal there from Occupied Ramallah. Thank you. Iran's foreign minister warns that the situation in the region will not remain the same if the Israeli regime's crimes against Palestinians continue. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said that Tehran will continue its efforts to stop the Israeli war crimes and will never fall short of its principles in supporting Palestine. He made the remarks during a meeting with the Hamas leader in Qatar. Ismail Haniyeh, for his part, said Operation Al-Aqsa Flood dealt a strategic blow to Israeli regime, and their war crimes in Gaza show their confusion. Earlier, Amir Abdullahian met with his Qatari counterpart and reiterated the need for ending the siege of the Gaza Strip and withholding food, water, and electricity. He has engaged on a diplomatic tour of West Asian countries focused on the Israeli strikes on the Gaza Strip. He's already visited Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria and met with high-ranking officials there. Israel is expanding its campaign of airstrikes, this time targeting Aleppo Airport in Syria. The Syrian Defense Ministry said the attack, which was carried out from the Mediterranean Sea, put the airport out of service. The airport just got back to service after simultaneous missile attacks by Israeli forces on the airports in Damascus and in Aleppo. The Damascus airport is still out of service. Meanwhile, the Israeli military says it has shelled Syria after air raid sirens were sounded in the occupied Golan Heights. It said the shelling was in response to two rocket launches from Syria. In recent years, Israel has conducted hundreds of airstrikes on the Syrian territory, targeting the army positions and other areas. Israel's recent airstrikes come in the wake of the regime's incessant bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip. Moving on, rallies have been held in various parts of the world in solidarity with Palestinians as the Israeli regime continues with its brutal aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip. In London, tens of thousands rallied in the British capital to express support for Palestinians. They held signs and chanted slogans as they marched from the BBC headquarters to Downing Street. Demonstrators called for an end to the Israeli bloodshed in Gaza. In Uppsala, Sweden, protesters called on the international community to take action and to stop Israeli crimes. In the Iraqi city of Nineveh, people gathered to condemn Israel and its allies for killing Palestinians. They hailed the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, launched by Hamas resistance movements. Similar rallies were held in the French capital, Paris, the Italian city of Milan, and the Turkish city of Istanbul.
Huge numbers of pro-Palestine demonstrators marched on Downing Street Saturday amid the UK government's outpouring of support for Israel's regime. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has spearheaded a controversial British response to the latest violence in Gaza, a reaction which many have condemned as reckless and criminal. Protesters are furious, and not just at the horrific images and videos coming out of occupied Palestine right now, but also at the British authorities, who are throwing accusations at protesters like this as somehow being anti-Semitic or sympathizing with terrorism, simply for coming out and supporting the Palestinian cause. Reports have already surfaced alleging that a Palestine activist in Manchester was arrested for wearing a Palestine flag. This comes after Home Secretary Suella Braverman warned that waving a Palestine flag could be classed as criminal in some cases.
First and foremost, it's very clear there is double standards. If a government is supporting Ukraine and Ukraine are resisting the occupation, then we have to say, why is there a double standard for the people in Palestine when we know, without a shadow of doubt, 70 years have gone by, they are under occupation. So holding a flag, it doesn't make sense for a people to come under attack only simply because they are showing solidarity for a people who are the Muslim and the people who are oppressed.
I feel disgusted and I feel unsurprised. At the end of the day, Palestinians, majority of us are Muslim. We are coloured. We are not European. So I'm unsurprised and I'm disgusted from the racism that's been going on. I'm absolutely disgusted and I'm unsurprised, but it needs to end now.
Of the Palestinian diplomatic representative.
In response to Britain's eagerness to support Israel amid the violence, Conservative Party MP Crispin Blunt issued a warning that the UK could face legal action if it does not do more to restrain Israel amid war crimes accusations.
I'm not entirely sure that my colleagues have quite grasped the legal peril that they are in or fully understand the international law in this area. You can't encourage powers to commit war crimes.
Onlookers watch in fear as Israel goes ahead with its bloodshed in the besieged Gaza Strip. Israel has already targeted Gaza with intense airstrikes. The brutal aggression has so far claimed the lives of more than 2,000 people and injured many others. Hundreds of thousands have also been internally displaced as a result of the regime's bombardment of the blockaded territory. Robert Carter, London.
6.3 magnitude earthquake has struck Afghanistan. It hit an area of western Herat province where around 1,000 people were recently killed by a series of strong quakes. For more details, we are now joined by our correspondent Abdullah Amirzada from the Afghan capital, Kabul. Well, that's the bad news for Afghanistan to experience another earthquake. What do you have for us, Abdullah?
Sure, that is a very bad news to see that another earthquake, the most powerful one up to now for the last 8 days, that the first earthquake shook Herat. It was a very bad news. I'm going through the whole story. The first earthquake 8 days ago shook Herat province, west of Afghanistan. The district is Zindajan, which is very close, almost 40 kilometers away from the province center. The first earthquake was about the magnitude of 5 or 6 and destroyed almost every house in 13 villages. The first earthquake had a very high death toll and casualties were high, but the numbers were vague. No one was sure. The first numbers suggested at least 2,000 dead and more than 2,000 injuries. But 3 days ago, the Ministry of Public Health in Afghanistan announced another update that suggested 1,000 people lost their lives and 1,500 people were injured. As a result of the first earthquake that shook Herat 8 days ago, many people were displaced. The access to water was cut. People needed food. Fortunately, neighboring countries, Iran, Pakistan, and some far countries like Turkey started sending their aid. People now are having access to water and food. There are also international organizations and national organizations like Red Crescent and WHO, WFP, helping people. But still, people are living in a very dire condition because the weather is cold and people are literally living in tents or in open air area. Today's earthquake, which is the strongest earthquake for the last 8 days, shook Herat almost 2 hours ago. The number of casualties is still unknown, but we don't expect to see a high number in the casualties because people had no home to live in. They had lost their homes already, and they were living in tents. Still, the Ministry of Public Health says that people need more water, more food, and they ask international organizations to bring more aid to those people.
Thank you for that. Abdullah Mirzada there, our correspondent there from Afghanistan. Stay safe. Thank you.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
The Zionist regime is on the rampage again, and Gaza's population is facing a quiet, slow path to erasure. The ones funding and enabling it are the US and its European allies. The truth is that this moment of catastrophe could never have been reached without Western powers indulging, subsidizing, and providing diplomatic cover for the Zionist regime's brutality towards the Palestinian people decade after decade. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, "The bloodiest hands in the current slaughter of Palestinians belongs both to the Zionist regime and the Western regimes. In fact, Western capitals know exactly how much the Palestinians of Gaza have been provoked because those same governments have been complicit for decades in supporting the Zionist regime as it has ethnically cleansed Palestinians from their homeland and imprisoned the remnants of the population in ghettos across their homeland. For the past 16 years, Western backing for the Zionist regime has not wavered, even as the fabricated regime of Israel has turned the coastal enclave of Gaza from the world's largest open-air prison into a gruesome torture chamber where Palestinians are experimented on. Their food and power have been rationed, essentials of life denied to them, their access to drinkable water slowly removed, and their hospitals prevented from receiving medical supplies and equipment." The problem is not ignorance. Western regimes have been informed in real time of the crimes the Zionist regime is committing, in confidential cables from their own embassy officials, and in endless reports from human rights groups documenting the Zionist regime's apartheid rule over Palestinians. And yet, Western politicians have time and again done nothing to intervene, done nothing to exert meaningful pressure. Worse, they have rewarded the Israeli regime with endless military, financial, and diplomatic support. The West is no less responsible now as the Zionist regime steps up its barbaric treatment of Gaza. The Zionist regime war minister, Yoav Gallant, decided this week to deepen the siege on Gaza by stopping all food and power, a crime against humanity. He has referred to the enclave's caged Palestinian population, men, women, and children, as human animals. Dehumanization, as history has proved time and again, is the prelude to ever greater outrages and horrors. How has the West responded? President Joe Biden has declared approvingly that a long war is ahead. Washington seems to relish long wars, which always prove a boon to its arms industries and a distraction from domestic troubles. Officials are already preparing to send missiles and bombs that will be used once again to kill Palestinian civilians from the air, as well as ammunition for the Zionist regime's troops to strafe Palestinian communities during the coming ground invasion. And of course, there will be plenty of extra funding for the fabricated regime of Israel, money that can never be found when it is needed by the most vulnerable U.S. citizens. Those funds will be on top of nearly $4 billion Washington currently sends each year to an Israeli regime of self-declared fascists and ethnic supremacists, whose express aim is to annex the last remaining fragments of Palestinian territory as soon as they can get the green light from Washington. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak does not want to be outdone, as the fabricated regime of Israel inflicts collective punishment on Gaza's Palestinians and begins to slaughter them every bit. A giant illuminated Zionist flag was emblazoned on the facade of the best-known home in Britain, 10 Downing Street, Sunak's official residence. The Prime Minister has offered military assistance and intelligence, presumably to help the Zionist regime bomb Gaza's caged population. The truth is that this moment of catastrophe could never have been reached without Western powers indulging, subsidizing, and providing diplomatic cover for the Zionist regime's brutality towards the Palestinian people decade after decade. Without such unstinking support, and without a complicit Western media refashioning the land thefts by settlers and the oppression by troops as some kind of humanitarian crisis, the Israeli regime could never have gotten away with its crimes. The Zionist regime has been free to pursue a policy of relentless escalation, sold by the Western media as calm or quiet until Palestinians try to hit back at their tormentors. Only then is the term escalation used. It is always Palestinians, as they say, escalating tensions. The permanent state of oppression inflicted by the Israeli regime can then be safely acknowledged and relabeled as retaliation. Palestinians are expected to suffer in silence, because when they make a noise, it risks reminding Western publics of how bogus, how self-serving Western leaders' appeals to the rules-based order truly are. Where does this endless indulgence from the West ultimately lead? Already, the Zionist regime is emboldened to make much more explicit its policy towards Gaza's 2 million inhabitants. Whether by design or outcome, the Zionist regime's starving of civilians, leaving them with no power, depriving them of clean water, and preventing hospitals from treating the sick and wounded, from treating those Israel has bombed, is a genocidal policy. Western regimes know this too, because the Zionist regime's leaders have made no secret of what they are doing. Western leaders watched through all this as Palestinian civilians, half the enclave's population, are children, were kept hungry, were denied drinkable water, were refused electricity, were denied proper medical care, and were repeatedly subjected to horrifying bombardments. Western politicians and media expect the Palestinians of Gaza to stay in their torture chamber, bite their lips, and suffer in silence, so conscience in the West are not disturbed. And the ones funding it, the ones enabling it, are the U.S. and its European allies. Their hands are the ones drenched in the blood of Gaza. Crescent International, meanwhile, wrote, led by U.S. President Joe Biden, Western politicians have unleashed a torrent of abuse and hatred against the Palestinians and their supporters. From the left, right, and center, politicians of all stripes have in unison condemned Hamas and the Palestinians in general for fighting for their right to free themselves from decades of Zionist occupation and oppression. The Zionist terrorists need no excuses. They have been perpetrating the genocide of Palestinians since before the illegitimate Zionist entity came into existence in 1948. What the Zionist war criminals are doing in Gaza today is genocide. There is no other way to describe it. American officials are notorious for telling lies to advance their nefarious agenda. And Biden is no exception.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. In today's program, we will be discussing American ambitions damaging Pakistan and Bollywood being used to spread Islamophobia. So stay tuned.
In this episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss Pakistan's relations with the United States of America, and we shall take a look at Islamophobia in Bollywood.
Is Pakistan trying to maintain a golden mean in its relations with China and America? There's an agreement in Pakistan on the importance of strategic relations with Beijing. But at the same time, many doubts have been raised on the nature of Islamabad's relations with Washington.
The decades-old relation between Pakistan and the United States has not been enduring. Instead, the ties have witnessed periods of antipathy and estrangement. In a recent interview with a U.S.-based media outlet, the Foreign Minister of Pakistan, Hina Rabbani Kar, said that Islamabad wants to have good relations with both Beijing and Washington and cannot choose between the two. However, periods of close ties between the two countries have been governed by America's requirement for Pakistan's cooperation to serve its strategic interests. On the other hand, Islamabad also needed economic and diplomatic help. Nevertheless, this symbiotic relation left both sides discontented. the relationship has done more bad than good to Pakistan, as a South Asian Muslim country does not share any long-term goals with America. It has also played a significant role in hindering Islamabad's relations with other countries. U.S. ties with Pakistan have obstructed democracy in the country, strengthening the army, in turn damaging the liberal and autonomous institution of Islamabad. It's important to note that the periods of close relations between the two countries were governed by military dictators in Pakistan. Support of military dictatorship by the White House and its imperialistic policies in the world has made the people of Pakistan wary and dissatisfied with the US.
During the Soviet-Afghan War and after the September 11 attacks, Pakistan did not have the flexibility to decide what role it wants to play in the United States' strategic ambitions. Islamabad was forced to act on the dictates of Washington, as Pakistan's compliance determined the economic support it would receive from America.
According to strategic relations experts, the reason for successive U.S. governments to have praised Pakistan was to manipulate the South Asian country to fulfill strategic interests. America's long-term strategic and economic ambitions never aligned with Islamabad, therefore the needs were met through transactional relations. The mere fulfillment of the U.S. designs that brought the two countries together has been followed by reprimanding Pakistan. In the 65-year period of ties between the two countries, Islamabad has been put under sanctions for 25 years, though the sanctions are not as severe as on Iran. Commenting on the alliance between the two countries, some foreign experts have been saying that Pakistan holds no permanent value for the United States, and its relation with Islamabad depends on Washington's ambitions in the South Asian region. The weaponization of the economic power by the US has destroyed weak countries like Pakistan. Islamabad is still battling with the deluge of America's war on terror in Afghanistan that led to the emergence of Takfiri groups that have affected the economy and security of the country considerably. Meanwhile, the failure of America's 20-year Afghan war speaks volumes about its problematic military and foreign policies.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Assistant Professor of International Relations, Federal Urdu University, Dr. Faisal Javed from Karachi. Welcome to the program, sir. It is believed that more than half a century of relations between the U.S. and Pakistan has done more harm than good to the South Asian Muslim country. What is your opinion on this, sir?
Thank you. It's a good question. And I teach my students in my class and discuss with my colleagues and friends. In international relations, Lord Palmerston said that there are no permanent friends and there are no permanent enemies, only permanent interests. So Pakistan and U.S. relations have faced several challenges in their relationship. Both countries are celebrating 75th anniversary of its relationship. The change in Pakistan-U.S. relations can be attributed to a combination of divergent strategic interests, trust issues, regional dynamics, external factors. So it's not one factor, several factors are playing the role. So Pakistan in the historically, after the independence, Pakistan decided to make the partner and make the partnership with U.S. against the Soviet Union. Pakistan decided to make a part with CETO and CENTO, the defense pact against the Soviet and communism expansion. So Pakistan, in the history, all the time, more than seven decades, Pakistan unconditionally supported to United States of America. But in the history, when Pakistan needed U.S. in 65 war, in 71 war, and other times, United States didn't come to support Pakistan in all the time. And right now, after Modi's visit to United States of America, both countries, and especially United States of America, where Pakistan in the history unconditionally supported in all the events for United States of America, for its interest against Soviet Union, against China, and even South Asia. and even the Middle East. So after 7 decades, we saw their relations are in the very low positions. And recently, Moody's visited the United States of America. This released a joint statement, and again, United States pushed Pakistan, don't use your land against the India, and stop the cross-border terrorism and other factors.
Coming to the second question, periods of military dictatorship in Pakistan led to closer ties with the U.S. Has Washington played a role in the weakening of democracy in Pakistan?
Again, it's a very, very good question. No doubt, Pakistan and U.S. relations, U.S. much focused and much better relation during military era. If we look in the history, in fact, when General Ayub Khan took over the government and imposed the martial law, before Skandar Mirza imposed the martial law, and he self became the president of Pakistan, United States and Pakistan had that time a good relation. And that time, United States used General Yahya Khan, General Ayub Khan against Soviet Union. So, and General Zia-ul-Haq, when he became the president and he became the head of Institute of head of Pakistan, so again he needed Pakistan against Soviet. When Soviet entered in Afghanistan, again this kind of military rule was supported and was helpful for United States of America to fulfill their interest in this region. And after 9/11. Again, General Musharraf was the president. Again, United States needed a military ruler in Pakistan, and again, they used in Afghanistan and to support and strengthen military leadership. And if we look in the history, America gave more aid, comparatively civilian eras, more aid to military rulers. And it's much focused on military rulers. So we can say America is responsibly, directly and indirectly, to weaken the democracy in Pakistan. And under the military rule, Pakistan aligned its foreign policy with U.S. interests, particularly in counterterrorism and other regional security issues. The alignment resulted in increased military and financial assistance from the U.S., further strengthening the bilateral ties.
Now, moving on to the next question. Islamabad was an ally of Washington in the so-called war on terror. How did this alliance damage Pakistan?
Oh, your question is a great question. No doubt, the war on terror has had a profound impact on Pakistan. It has damaged the country's economically, socially, and politically. It has also damaged Pakistan's international reputation. The country has paid a heavy price for its alliance with Washington. The war against terrorism has significantly impacted Pakistan economically, and its estimated cost around $126 billion we lost in the term of revenue, damage to infrastructure, and increased security spending. The country's economy has also been hurt by the loss of tourism and investment. The war has led to increased radicalization and violence in Pakistan. There have been numerous terrorist attacks on civilians and military installations. I think roughly it's around more than 60,000 people were killed. Right now we are paying this kind of loss. Right now we are facing this kind of terrorism. Impacts we are facing. This has created a climate of fear and insecurity in the country. Pakistan's reputation has been damaged by the war. The country has been accused of harboring terrorists and of not doing enough to combat extremism.
Now, moving on to a very important question. In the changing world order, Pakistan will have to choose between the U.S. and China. Sir, will Islamabad maintain close ties with Beijing, knowing that Pakistan holds no permanent value for America?
Yes, it is true that the current changing world order is likely to put pressure on Pakistan to choose between the U.S. and China. The U.S. is no longer the sole superpower in the world, and China is rising rapidly. This has led to a shift in the balance of power in the region, and Pakistan is caught in the middle. Pakistan has traditionally been close to the U.S., but the relationship has been strained recent years, especially after U.S. withdrawal and during when they decide U.S. withdrawal. The U.S. has been critical for Pakistan's support for terrorist groups, and it has also suspended, sometimes reduced, aid to Pakistan on several occasions. This has led to some Pakistani, said U.S. Commitment. They have raised some questions about commitment with the Pakistan relationship. On the other hand, if we look on China, China, on the other hand, has been a reliable partner for Pakistan. China has provided Pakistan with billions of dollars in loan investments when Pakistan needed. Earlier, I replied to your questions. Pakistan lost around $126 billion in war against terrorism. So this gap filled by China. China announced CPAC and announced $64 billion in different sectors, in infrastructure, in energy, and other sectors. This thing is helpful for Pakistan to strengthen its economy, its infrastructure, and other things. And it has also helpful for Pakistan with the nuclear program. This has led to growing relationship between two countries, and history proved that China is time-tested and reliable partner than the U.S. It is, we cannot say in the future, it is possible that the country will try to maintain close ties with the both the U.S. and China. However, it is possible that Pakistan will have to choose between the two countries. If Pakistan does choose China, it will be the sign that the country is no longer willing to be pawn in the U.S.-China rivalry. U.S.-China is a major economic partner for Pakistan. The country is likely to want to maintain close ties with China in order to secure access to China market and investment.
On that note, I would like to thank Assistant Professor of International Relations, Federal Urdu University, Dr. Faisal Javed from Karachi. Thanks for being on the program, sir. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Yasser Khan, a netizen, tweeted, America has welcomed Riek Musharraf, an army dictator in the past, just as they have welcomed almost every dictator from Pakistan. So what are we crying for? It is about personal interests right now. America sees its interest in healthy relations with India. So why are we Pakistanis crying? Nagabhat from India tweeted, regular school shootings, transgender grooming, opioids crisis, support to jihadi groups in Libya, Syria, and Pakistan, support to drug lords in South America, bombing of ancient sites in Vietnam really befits Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam needs to know that it will get as much as it gives. Ali Imran, whose bio says a patriot from Lahore, tweeted, my Pakistan is burning under this current imported fascist and corrupt regime, which is imposed by Pakistani corrupt re-establishment with the help of Uncle Sam and company. People are suffering from the high inflation, corruption and fascism.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent here on IRIB English Radio.
Cinema holds the ability to inspire, entertain, and challenge societal norms. Fortunately, a disturbing trend that has infiltrated the Indian film industry in recent years is Islamophobia. Bollywood, as a means of soft power, has become a ground for hateful and anti-Muslim narratives, painting a distorted image of Islam and Muslims.
The Indian film industry, once celebrated for fostering communal harmony and promoting Hindu-Muslim unity, is now complicit in producing films that spread hatred and stereotypes against the Muslims of India. Movies such as Kashmir Files and the recently released The Kerala Story have normalized the vilification of Muslims, portraying them as violent and oppressive. the Kerala story, premised on the Hindutva conspiracy theory of love jihad, portrays Muslims as declassed individuals. The movie falsely claimed conversion of thousands of Hindu women from Kerala to Islam, followed by getting recruited in the terrorist group ISIS. Kashmir Files, that was released in 2022, presents a distorted view of Kashmiri Muslims. Instead of highlighting the struggles of both Muslims and Hindus during the 1990s, when the valley was gripped by violence, the film unjustly portrays Muslims as the culprits, ignoring their efforts to protect the Hindu minority. Bollywood, being used as a soft power with its immense popularity, enabled these narratives to reach millions, influencing public opinion and perpetuating stereotypes. Regrettably, media literacy remains low amongst the masses, making them susceptible to misinformation and false narratives propagated through Bollywood. These films, with their anti-Islam and anti-Muslim language, propagate the notion that Islam is a savage, oppressive, and violent religion, weaving webs of prejudice and division that threaten the very fabric of the multicultural Indian society.
Bollywood's influence in shaping India's national identity and the global community's opinion of India cannot be overstated. However, in recent times, it has become a tool in the hands of organizations covertly designed to create a Hindu-dominated society where Muslims are relegated to the status of second-class citizens.
Over the past decade, Bollywood has become a powerful propaganda machine, spreading misinformation and reinforcing false narratives through movies. These movies are not isolated incidents. They represent a broader trend within Bollywood, where Islamophobic content has become a profitable venture. Financial interests often drive the production of such films, exploiting hate as the currency of choice in today's entertainment industry. An alarming trend is that these films are often exempted from taxes in the states under the ruling BJP party. Generating substantial revenue, it highlights the popularity of hate-centric narratives. The financial interests of the filmmakers seem to align with the propagation of divisive politics, exploiting Islamophobia for monetary and political gains. According to media experts, one of the objectives of the production of such films is to divert people's attention from real issues such as rampant unemployment and economic hardships. Studies have shown that local media play a significant role in promoting these films and changing the country's political discourse. Give time coverage to the recently released Islamophobic films helps the ruling political parties that work in alliance with the media divert the attention from significant issues affecting the lives of the masses. Promoting a distorted version of history, these movies assist in manipulating the common people, fulfilling particular political agendas.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by lawyer and researcher, member of Article 21 Trust Think Tank, Asif Ali Zaidi from New Delhi. Welcome to the program, sir. Let's talk about Bollywood. In what way has Bollywood's portrayal of Islam and the Muslim community evolved over the years? What factors have contributed to the recent surge in Islamophobic narratives?
So thank you so much for having me for this discussion. So if we look back at the history of, you know, Bollywood and Islamic and Muslim portrayals, we have seen, like, post-partitions, we have movies like Mughal-e-Azam and Amar Akbar and Tony and, you know, Barsaat, which echoed the, you know, sense of communal harmony and also the secularism. But again, in such movies, we have, you know, the portrayal of Muslims, you know, were very, like, it was very stereotypical in nature. Like, we, when we see movies like, you know, Amar Akbar and Thoni, Akbar has been shown as a darzi wearing, you know, cap, having a taweez in, you know, in his neck, and his eyes are cold. So this is how, like, Muslims have been portrayed. But yes, they were not communal in nature. But then we have seen movies like post-partition, like post-Babri Masjid demolition. We have movies like Bombay and Mrs. and Mr. Iyer, which showed the complex relation between Hindus and Muslims. Post 9/11, we have seen the global surge in Islamophobia, and Bollywood was not immune from that. though there were, like, you know, attempts in terms of the movies like My Name Is Khan, where they have the, you know, portrayal of Muslim, and they try to, you know, sympathize with Muslim characters. But still, you know, there has been a continuous surge. And then post 2014, we have movies like Kashmir Files, we have Kerala Story, Panipat, we have Padmavat, which are very Islamophobic in nature. So basically, these movies had, you know, these instances, the hardened instances, had metastasized the Islamophobia. So what the factors with which I really feel could possible to, like, you know, to galvanize this Islamophobia would be like socio-political environment of the country, because most of the time we have seen India is marred by communal tension in between Hindus and Muslims. So this could be one of the, like, you know, reasons for that. And again, there, and the another factor could be the, you know, the deep-seated, you know, biases and prejudice within the communities. So this is again is one of the factors on which the Islamophobic movies are made. And, you know, third factor could be the political alignment of the filmmakers.
Moving on to the second question. In a heterogeneous society like India, what can be the reason for the production and promotion of Islamophobic films in Bollywood? Do they intersect with political agendas?
Yes, there are, you know, a couple of factors that basically, you know, lead to the Islamophobic content that has been, you know, made by the Bollywood. And yes, there exists, you know, an intersection with the political ideology as well. So, for example, if we look, you know, one of the important factors, that is the political instrumentalization of the movies through the art and media. Because as I have, you know, said in the previous question as well, so most of the time in the movies we have seen, like, the directors and the producers of the particular movie have their aligned, you know, they have aligned to a particular ideology. For example, in the movie Kashmir Files, we have very, like, clearly noted that there has been a misinformation, there has been a, you know, clear distortion of fact and histories, and the movies were, you know, promoted by those in powers. So, for example, Prime Minister Narendra Modi himself has said that, you know, Kashmir Files is basically, you know, uncovers the truth.
Mr. Zaidi, as we have seen, some of these Islamophobic films get endorsed by influential figures. The publicity contribute, films' popularity and financial gains. In addition to that, what impact does it have on a diverse society like India?
Yes. So, as I have said earlier, when the Kashmir file